Good evening. It is Thursday, January 2nd. Happy New Year of 2020. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. For the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. According to Common Dreams, Trump's Social Security Administration wants people with disabilities to prove it. The Social Security Administration is out to, quote, enhance program integrity, end quote, and maintain appropriate stewardship by increasing the frequency of continuing disability reviews, known as CDRs, to which disabled people who receive Social Security payments are subjected. This is a ominous development indeed. We touched on this last week in a slightly broader context. How big of an issue is this, and will it actually cut fraud, waste, and abuse? For insight into this, we turn to my first guest. She's a co-editor of Popular Resistance, Dr. Margaret Flowers. Margaret, welcome back.
Thank you for having me, Leon.
So currently, disabled people who fall into the category of medical improvement expected, they get a continuing disability review every 6 to 18 months. Those categorized as medical improvement possible get one every 3 years. And those in the third category, medical improvement not expected, only have to go through the process every 5 to 7 years. What are the new changes, and what do you see the possible impact being?
Well, the new changes create a new category, improvement likely, and requires them to get a review every 2 years. And so this is just another way of adding more bureaucracy to the system, more burden onto people who are already, you know, have enough on their hands to deal with life in general. And now these reviews, which are really just kind of used as a way, you know, it makes it easier for people to be able to lose their benefits. And so it just puts more burden on them and more risk and stress of having to continue to prove that they can, you know, that they need the support that they're getting. And so this is, you know, this is a problem with the system that we have that's not a human rights-based system, but actually kind of creates more barriers for people and more burden for people to just get what they need to live their daily lives.
If you could expand on that, and hopefully this question is the question to get us there. Those who don't understand what's involved in the process would most likely say, well, if you claim a disability, then you should have to prove that you are disabled on an ongoing basis if you want to continue to receive disability benefits under Social Security. So elaborate and explain why that argument is not as simple as it sounds.
Well, Social Security, you know, and it's very likely that they don't have the resources and the people that they need to do the work that they're doing, because for people to even qualify for Social Security benefits, I mean, it's just a given that they're going to be denied those benefits on their first round of applying, even when they have, you know, serious disability. And they have to apply over and over to finally prove that they're disabled and that they need to get their assistance. And then this creates a burden on them of now they have to go through that again periodically to continue to prove that they're disabled enough to continue to get those benefits. And it's really just a system that's not designed to be supportive or in favor or make it easy for people. It's more of kind of a punitive type of system that keeps putting the burden on people to prove that they still need the assistance that they're getting. And so this just creates a lot of stress and paperwork for people who are already struggling to have to continue to prove this. And it just, if it were a system that really, I mean, there would be easier ways to do this, right? I mean, if you had whoever is providing care to those people who was required by law to give updates on if there are any changes in people's conditions. You know, there's ways to take the burden off of the individual, but to make it more of a system type approach that would be more of, well, we'll you know, let you know if there are changes, as opposed to putting people through this kind of stressful process that if everything is not done exactly perfectly, and I'm sure people are very familiar with what happens when maybe you didn't check the box right or you didn't say things exactly the way you're supposed to say them, that people risk losing what they need in order to be able to meet their basic necessities and function in life.
So I guess the question becomes, in designing this whole process, what is the focus and what is the intent? If the intent is to be sure that people receiving benefits are receiving the proper level of benefit and care, that's one thing. If your objective is to knock people off the rolls,
right,
to allegedly save money, which we can get into that conversation, your design is driven by your intent.
Exactly. And you said it very eloquently. That's exactly what the problem is. It's not designed to actually support people's needs and make sure they're getting what they need.
It's designed to knock people off the rolls. And it's not as though we're talking about a lot of money. So let me not make that assumption. Let me pose the question to you. What do you see as a doctor? What do you see as the cost savings here? Is this really going to reap the cost-saving benefit that it is intended to? And the other question is, where are these people going to go once their benefits have been taken from them or reduced?
Right. And that's the really important question here, is like, as a society, who is it that we go after in these types of approaches to save money? We're going after some of our most vulnerable population who, you know, if you're getting disability benefits, that's still a poverty existence. And you actually have to maintain that poverty existence, because if your income were to go up, you know, very minimally, then you can no longer qualify for Medicaid, which many people who have disabilities, you know, rely on that for being able to get health care, for getting transportation to their health care. If we look at the big scheme of where is our money going, you know, the corporations like the fossil fuel corporations and others that get tremendous subsidies, billions, tens of billions, maybe hundreds of billions of dollars a year in subsidies, the private insurance companies that are getting hundreds of billions of dollars a year in subsidies from our public dollars, and then they go out and keep most of that and try not to deliver health care. You know, if we want to save money, we know who has the money. We could tax the wealthy. We could decrease our military spending easily. But instead, this is a system that's targeting, once again, those who are most vulnerable and trying to squeeze people who are already impoverished into being more impoverished. And where do they go? Well, if they're not lucky enough to have a family member or a friend who can help support them, then they end up on the street and they suffer and sometimes they die.
And let's also talk about the fact, and I think this is a fact, that where we are right now in the process and the solutions that are being provided come as no surprise. We can go back to President Clinton and his redefining welfare as we know it, and understand that there has been an ongoing attack on social programs. We could go back to Ronald Reagan, but we really, I think, see this focused starting with Bill Clinton and moving forward. So we've been told for a very long time that the game here was to increase military spending, continue to feed the military-industrial complex, and then we would get to a point where the argument would be, see, we don't have any money anymore for these social programs. We have to cut them because we're broke.
Right. And it's very interesting that just, you know, before the new year, Congress passed the new military budget, $738 billion. We've seen a $120 billion increase in military spending since President Obama left office. And at the same time, Congress was deciding to cut food services, you know, the SNAP program, food stamps, to 700,000 people. And we know that there's so much waste in our military budget that even when they tried to audit the Pentagon, they were not able to account for trillions of dollars, or billions of dollars. The Pentagon failed its audit. So this, again, it looks at the priorities. And what could we do differently? I mean, one simple thing that is very popular and people are pushing for is a national improved Medicare for All single-payer healthcare system, which would include health care for people who, well, everything that they need, including long-term care, including home-based and community care as a priority, and allowing people who are disabled to make the choices about where they receive their care. And in that kind of a system, it's already going to be a transparent system. It'll be one system for the entire country. It'd be very easy for health professionals and other caregivers to give updates if there are changes, and very easy for the government to then go in and look at if someone's situation has changed and then assess them based on that. There are ways that we could design a system that would make it much more easier to communicate and for the burden to be taken off of that particular individual.
And to the $738 billion Defense Authorization Act, and the president and conservatives, they love to talk about national emergency and they love to talk about the war on terror. But what is actually happening here, I believe, is a national emergency is being created, and it's being created on a number of different levels. One, again, where do the people who you take off of these roles, where do they go? And the other question is, or the other point, I think, is that as the have-nots continue to look at the growing chasm between themselves and the haves, a level of discontent is going to bubble up to the surface that will create a national emergency, the likes of which most folks really don't want to see.
Right. I mean, if you look at our own history in this nation, particularly at the beginning of the last century, you know, when there were huge uprisings, or the middle of the century with the civil rights movement, yes, if you don't provide basic needs for people, if you don't provide basic rights and dignity for people, they will eventually get fed up and protest. And we see around the world right now, if you look in Latin America, in Chile particularly, where, you know, with believed to be such a successful neoliberal capitalist economy, and now there are huge ongoing protests there. Look at France, where now protesters have been, I think it's almost 60 weeks now, of weekly protests against the austerity measures and the unfair policies. Look at Lebanon and other places. So this is something that will hit home, and we're looking at a situation of extreme fragility in our economic system with the very high levels of debt and high risk kind of financial maneuvers that are going on. So I think it's important for people in the United States to realize, one, that you can't continue squeezing people and not expect them to push back against that, but two, that the United States, for being one of the wealthiest economies in the world, has a very poor social safety net. We are not prioritizing the needs of our people or protection of the planet. We do not have the employment support, the pensions, the health care that, you know, that other countries have, education, you name it. And so, you know, at some point we need to recognize that we are basically being robbed, you know, of these services that governments are supposed to provide to feed this, you know, this corporate elite, this military-industrial complex, instead of, you know, feeding ourselves.
Also, if you could quickly talk about the disproportionate racial dynamic at play here, as well as the demographic. I think women will be disproportionately impacted by this as well.
Right. Well, you know, in general, our economy is really designed in a racially unequal way. And you can see that in the wealth divide between, you know, black people and white people, the extreme wealth divide there. And just recently, the Economic Policy Institute put out a series of charts kind of giving a sense of the 2019 economy. They found that black college graduates are much more likely to be unemployed or underemployed than white college graduates, and that I think it was close to 40% of them are, when they do find jobs, do not find jobs that are in the field for which they studied for those jobs. So there are a lot of systemic issues that we have throughout our economy from, you know, from every aspect of it, racially, you know, unjust policies that we need to be addressing in this country. And of course, again, you know, there's just kind of inherent discrimination in our country as well. And so, you know, are people going to get fair treatments in these reviews, or are there going to be assumptions made about them that may cause the person doing the review to not, you know, be as favorable to them as they might be to someone who's Caucasian or white-skinned?
And so, again, as we look at upon whose back are these savings going to be made, to the point that you made earlier, the administration, and again, we can't just limit this to the Trump administration, because the Obama administration did this, the Bush administration did this, the Clinton administration did this, going all the way back to this whole misperception created by Ronald Reagan of the welfare queen, and that you've got these people that are on the public dole and that they're taking advantage of. Very few people, I think, really want to sit back and just try to live off of Social Security, because that's not enough money for even to reach the poverty level.
Right. And I mean, I live in Baltimore City, so I see regularly that people in poor communities are constantly asking for, they're asking for jobs for youth during the summertime. They're asking for their recreation centers not to be shut down. They're asking for more for their schools. They're asking for job training as the city builds new office buildings and complexes. People are saying, why don't you train us in the service jobs that will be needed for those buildings? And so, you know, it's not like people, exactly as you said, people want to work. They want to have a decent living. They want to have decent housing to live in and a decent life. And our government is not prioritizing that. You know, I know that you know that I've been very involved in what's going on in Venezuela and, you know, defending the, you know, the democratically elected government down there, which has been targeted by U.S. economic coercive measures now for years. And despite that, they have managed to build, they just finished their 3 millionth public housing. They call it social housing down there. They have a population of 32 million, and they've built in just the last years 3 million public housing units. In the United States, we have over 320 million people, 10 times the population, and we have 1.1 million public housing units, and we're losing them. So we have a third of what they have for 10 times the population. This just shows you the difference between how our government is prioritizing people's needs versus what is done in other countries that actually think these things are human rights. They treat housing, healthcare, the right to vote as human rights.
That's a great point as you look at the gentrification that's taking place in so many of our urban centers. There are a number of just beautiful, architecturally gorgeous buildings that are going up. But you have to ask yourself, well, what happened to the folks that were displaced by this building? Because we know they can't afford to live there.
Right. And they are displaced. You know, the city often promises them that, oh, no, we will find a place for you to go. But they don't end up placing them. What we're seeing in Baltimore is kind of the city decreasing the public housing population through attrition. So when a unit becomes empty, they don't clean it or they don't put somebody into that unit. We're facing a situation where Johns Hopkins, which is such a big landowner in Baltimore City, is trying to push out the public housing.
It continues to expand.
Yeah, right around their campus.
Like the Leviathan.
Yes.
I got to stop you there. Dr. Margaret Flowers, as always, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your contribution to the Critical Hour. Happy New Year, and look forward to having you back.
Thank you. Happy New Year to you.
Thank you, Margaret. Folks, you're listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. The fourth quarter fundraising numbers are in. President Trump's reelection campaign said today that it raked in $46 million in the fourth quarter of 2019 amid House Democrats' impeachment proceedings. Senator Bernie Sanders' campaign said that he brought in more than $34.5 million in fundraising during the fourth quarter, and Andrew Yang raised $16.5 million. Well ahead of the nearly $10 million he collected in the third quarter. Do these numbers signal problems for the Democratic establishment as they are now in the stretch run for 2020? For insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He's Dean of the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Virginia State University, Dr. Leneil Henderson. Happy New Year and welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Happy New Year to you, and happy to be back.
Thank you. So, Trump's reelection campaign and the Republican National Committee, they brought in a combined $125 million in the third quarter, but the fourth quarter numbers were raised by the president's reelection campaign alone. That's a great war chest for a guy who's been impeached. So let's start the conversation with Trump. Has this made him a stronger opponent than expected? Or going into this, did we know that money was not going to be the issue, that this battle was really going to have to be waged based on policy and politics?
I think the latter. I think it's not surprising that Trump would raise this amount of money given the resources of his base, which includes a lot of the people that he's been advocating for in public policy, mostly the 1% plutocracy. So it doesn't surprise me that he would get these numbers, and it actually surprises me that he doesn't have more at this stage of the game. So that's not a big surprise to me.
Now, Bernie Sanders has raised $18 million in the month of December alone and brought in contributions from 40,000 new donors on the final day of the fourth quarter. That's according to his campaign. The latest haul is roughly $9 million more than his third quarter fundraising haul of $25.3 million. Understanding that Democratic leadership really can't stand Bernie Sanders, do his numbers signal an ideological problem for leadership?
Yes, they do, because that cleavage left to right within the Democratic Party, left to moderate, continues to be pretty obvious for the Democrats. And
explain that, please.
Well, what I mean here is that all during the campaign, you know, Trump has made a lot out of what he calls the socialist leanings of the Democratic Party, that they're really all socialists.
Mm-hmm.
What he's really talking about is Bernie Sanders and
Elizabeth Warren.
People further to the left, Elizabeth Warren mm-hmm. and so on.
Right.
But for the Democrats, the mainstream Democrats, you know, led by Nancy Pelosi, the problem for them is that Bernie Sanders continues to be popular, and he's not only popular, but he's popular among young people, black people, Latinos, and increasingly older people. And the reason for that is his advocacy for policies that have to do with the middle class and have to do with the lower classes. Now, the other problem he presents for them is his age. You know, and I'm in the same generation, so I can't talk, but his age is the same problem that Biden has, but Biden is a different beast altogether in this campaign. So what I mean here is that the Democrats don't really want to publicly and obviously embrace Bernie Sanders because he is a declared socialist running on the Democratic ticket. And they see that as politically expensive to them going into the 2020 race.
Before we get to your comment about Senator Sanders' popularity among African Americans, am I wrong in reading into this, and we're going to get to Yang in just a second, am I wrong to read into this that these numbers are indicating a growing consensus within the Democratic electorate that the elite or party leadership is refusing to recognize? Are they fighting a losing battle here by trying to ignore or dismiss the, quote, socialist leanings of Bernie Sanders and how that's resonating within the electorate?
Yeah, I think they're fighting a battle. I don't know if it's a losing battle, but they're certainly fighting it. And we're seeing the potential for the same cleavage we saw with Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders back in 2016.
That's my point.
If the Democrats don't reach some kind of rapprochement with Bernie Sanders. I think it's going to be very important for them to do that. My problem, you know, Wilmer, is that, you know, Bernie Sanders is a very appealing candidate for a cross-section of folks in the Democratic Party. But the bottom line is, can he beat Trump? Can he win? And that's what the Democrats have got to ask themselves and are asking themselves at the leadership level. And those so-called mainstream Democrats are saying, no, we can't win with Bernie Sanders. We love to support him. We like him in a lot of ways, like what he stands for. But we can't go that way because we're too easy a target for President Trump and his supporters.
The language, can he win? I have been saying, and I know you will correct me if I'm wrong, I've been saying that I don't really see that being a mathematical calculation. I see that being more code language by the elite about, do we want to go that road? Or another way of putting it, it's not so much can he win, it's will he disaffect those white male middle class voters that the Democrats continue to try to hang on to?
Yeah, I think both of those are connected, Wilmer. I mean, the latter point that you make about the disaffected white voters and can he win are actually linked questions.
Mm-hmm.
Because if the Democrats don't do well with those categories, they're going to have a challenge. But the other question is, how will he do with women, both white women and women of color?
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's going to do quite well with women, white women and women of color. And I think the support of Ocasio-Cortez is just one example of that, but there are other examples of that as well. If we subtracted Elizabeth Warren, not Amy Klobuchar, but Elizabeth Warren, I think the Bernie Sanders math would be a little different than it is right now. I think he would get much more support from women than any of the other Democratic candidates that I can see, including Klobuchar. So, you know, that the Warren factor has to be connected to our discussion about the Sanders factor.
And again, one more point before we get to Andrew Yang. You made the point that Bernie is popular among African-American people. There are a lot of analysts who keep saying, oh, wait till Joe gets to South Carolina and all those black people in South Carolina, they love them some Joe Biden. If you would, talk about your thoughts about Bernie's message resonating within the African-American community.
Well, I think South Carolina is clearly, you know, Biden camp as far as African-Americans are concerned. But, you know, you've got Mississippi, you've got the other southern states, you've got black people in the north central part of the United States and the western part of the United States. So South Carolina is not the entirety of the African-American political reality when it comes to Bernie Sanders or Democrats or Biden.
Especially ideologically,
you know. So I think urban black folks, especially in the larger cities, have some questions about Biden. I mean, about whether or not he really is supporting the things that they're concerned about, you know, taxes and, policies on discrimination and income maintenance. And we can go down the list, health care, of course. So I think if Bernie was the same age as Buttigieg, we wouldn't be having this discussion.
Right.
But I do think age is a factor because Bernie's, 78, 79 years old. Biden is 77. So what we've got here also is the generational reality to deal with, you know. So I think that as we've talked about before, Sanders continues to be strong and popular because you can understand his message. He's unwavering. He sticks by what he's saying. And his average campaign contribution is like $27 over that $40,000.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the $46 million that Trump raised, they probably came from no more than 300 sources.
I was going to say 46.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But 300 powerful sources.
Right.
So that's the difference in the base. Yeah.
And to your point about Bernie and black people, Stacey Abrams, who is incredibly popular, she came out of the Bernie camp.
Right. Correct.
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez out of New York. To your point about
Absolutely.
Urban centers, she came out of the Bernie camp. So did
Absolutely.
Rashida Tlaib in Detroit and Ilhan Omar in Minnesota. All of them have come out of the Bernie camp.
Right. So this is not, you know, this is serious business. And I think also Trump's use of the social tactic is reminiscent of the McCarthy years and is his way of deflecting attention from all of the things that he is doing to support the 1%, you know, rich plutocracy we have here.
Mm-hmm.
And also his very, very awful foreign policies, because I think one of the things the Democrats are going to have to hit hard on are foreign policy issues as well as domestic policy issues, because this man has wrecked our relationships with allies. He's played into the Russians' hands when it's coming to damaging NATO and weakening, our alliance base. And, you know, the Democrats have had to pick up and deal with that. That is also the key to a lot of our domestic issues, because our economies are inextricably intertwined with the global economy.
Mm-hmm.
So I find that Sanders hits those issues very directly and very clearly. He quietly says America first, but he does not ignore the rest of the world as Trump does.
Andrew Yang, he fell well short of Bernie Sanders' 34.5 million, but his numbers are still incredibly impressive, which is why I wanted to include him in this conversation and link him to Bernie Sanders, because Andrew Yang, he's the one that's promising to guarantee every American a basic government-funded income. So he's on the incredibly progressive side of the argument as well. So when you put Bernie and Andrew Yang together, I'm, as you taught me years ago, focused on policy. Their policy initiatives, to me, are what should be very concerning to the Democratic leadership.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because we're making commitments here that have fiscal ramifications as well as public policy ramifications. And if you're talking about guaranteeing an income to everybody, you got to sort of add up what that means fiscally. Now, the other side of this is that this is coming from a man who's an entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got to distinguish between sort of the entrepreneurial culture and the traditional large-scale corporate culture. He does not come from that orientation. However, policy analysts will tell you that even those who get government subsidies spend money in the economy.
Right.
So the money still gets back to the economy through the beneficiary.
And faster.
And faster
because what those individuals with less means have, what they spend it on. They spend it on milk and shoes and rent. They don't spend it on yachts and minks and watches.
Absolutely. And the only thing they don't spend it on as much because they can't afford to is to save it and to invest it.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
But it does get back into the economy. There's a sort of multiplier effect here. And that's the thing we miss, by the way, about most income maintenance programs. The real beneficiary is what the money the household spends on and not just the household. And so if we look at the full economic impact of any kind of government program or subsidy, it really is the economy that benefits and not just the individual or the household.
It's the real economy. It's not the financialized economy that is
Correct.
Controlled by
Correct.
Goldman Sachs and Wells Fargo and the military-industrial complex.
Exactly right. So that's the real dynamic. So the other thing that's interesting about Yang, I would mention, of course, is here's a guy with no experience as an elected official, but a very, very astute observer and analyst of politics and policy. And also the fact that he's an Asian American cannot be lost on us as well, because, that has some obvious implications for our relationships with the many Asian countries that we have strained relationships with, and he comes out of the Silicon Valley experience and so on and so forth. So he understands business at some fundamental levels. So I think it's interesting that he's raised more money than some elected officials who were in the campaign or mm-hmm. former elected officials mm-hmm. or appointed officials like Julian Castro and, of course, Kamala Harris. And we can go down the list.
And Julian Castro just dropped out today.
He just dropped out. And I think I was sad to see that, actually, because, I think that this 2020 campaign is a huge opportunity for the Democrats to relate to the Latino community and vote in a way they haven't done before. It always helps if you have a strong Latino candidate in the race,
Mm-hmm.
But he may, all of these people that are dropping out now may come back later if the Democrats win or if they can't come to consensus at the convention about who their nominee is going to be. These folks can be queen and kingmakers, And of course, if the Democrats get elected and the Senate goes back to the Democrats, we may see these folks as cabinet officials and, see them in a sort of resurrected light. So just because they drop out doesn't mean they die politically.
You and I earlier today were talking about Citizens United, and I wanted you to quickly touch on that. You thought that Citizens United was a key element that needed to be discussed in this context.
Yeah, it does, because I think what Citizens United did back in 2010 was to take all the caps off of campaign contributions at the national level, in contradiction to the 1974, election reform campaign laws,
mm-hmm.
which tried to rein in large corporate and other kinds of contributions that could sway the election. So what it did essentially was allow President Trump to buy the Republican primary himself.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, to get the Republican National Committee to help him with the general election. Now, the Democrats have an opportunity to do something with that on their own. I don't think they'll be as egregious in exploiting that opportunity as Trump and the Republicans were, but they have an opportunity to do that. And so this is relevant to Yang because so a person like Yang with no experience as an elected official could go to all kinds of sources to get money here, and he's not sort of constrained by the old limits and caps on how much money you can raise for your campaign.
Also, then you got to throw in Bloomberg and Steyer because they have very, very deep pockets.
Absolutely.
And access, because of their deep pockets, they have access to deep pockets.
Absolutely. And one of the dangerous things about that for both Democrats and Republicans is that it makes them manipulable by international oligarchs and others who have their own interests in what the United States is doing and can finance campaigns directly or indirectly abroad, you know. So that's the other danger of having those caps, especially since we acknowledge that the Russians did interfere in the 2016 election. We didn't say specifically how, but you can't discount the role of Russian oligarchs and their friends in the campaign financially, not just politically.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so, one of the things about Citizens United is that it opens some doors to surreptitious international influences financially, both legal and not so legal, as well as domestic ones.
Dr. Lanil Henderson, as always, sir, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your contribution to the Critical Hour. Happy New Year, and look forward to having you back.
Thank you so much. Appreciate the opportunity, and take care of yourself now.
Thank you. All right, folks, you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Will Brexit bring the Troubles back to Northern Ireland? As the United Kingdom confronts the prospect of dissolution, old factions are bracing for the possibility of new violence. For insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He's a political analyst and commentator and editor of The Polemicist. His latest piece can be found at Counterpunch and The Polemicist, entitled Impeachment, What Lies Beneath? Jim Kavanaugh. Jim, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thanks for having me.
We're also joined by an investigative reporter and founder of the news collective This Can't Be Happening, Dave Lindorf. Dave, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So the 1998 peace deal, known as the Good Friday Agreement, subdued the violence in Northern Ireland, but it did not resolve the underlying sectarian conflict that propelled it. Northern Ireland is in the United Kingdom, unionists or loyalists who tend to identify as Protestant and as British, they want it to remain that way. Nationalists or Republicans, small r, who tend to identify as Catholic and Irish, they want a united Ireland. Let me start with Jim Kavanaugh. How is this whole Brexit deal going to play out as it relates to what we knew as the Troubles?
Well, I think in the not so long run, in fact, now it's going to help the cause of Irish reunification, and it is working, to strengthen the pitch that Irish nationalists are making that it should be one country, because most of the country wanted to remain in Europe, and now what's created is a situation where there's a de facto economic border on the Irish Sea, and you've got this situation where Ireland North and South becomes a single economic unit as opposed to Great Britain. And if one thing Brexit itself showed is that when you try to separate political power from economic power and have an economic unit that's different from a political unit, you get all kinds of troubles and resentments. So I think that in a lot of ways, demographically, politically, for quite some time, the nationalists in Ireland and Sinn Féin has been playing a long game that they're winning. And it's going to be hard to resist that in the not so long run. I'm talking about a decade or so. On the other hand, I think there is a potential for at least sporadic reemergence of violent acts, especially on the part of the unionists. But it's going to be hard for them to find a target. I mean, I was in Belfast. I saw it. It was the most segregated city I've ever seen. 30-foot walls between neighborhoods and simmering resentments still there. People, you know, whose family members weren't, you know, were killed by the other side, you know, brothers and sisters and mothers and fathers. So there's still a lot of simmering resentment. And there is a potential for outbursts of violence, I think, again. But I don't think it can get enough traction.
Dave Lindorf, the same question to you. And are we looking at economic divisions versus political divisions?
Well, they really are trying to, you know, Boris Johnson government is trying to paper over the problem that they've created with Brexit, but it's not something they can really paper over. You've got, you know, on the one side, the unionists are totally opposed to his solution, which is to make a new border, being the Irish Sea. And so sort of allowing to a soft border without, you know, passports required and you know, customs inspections at the border between the north and with Ireland itself. And then, you know, goods would get checked before they'd get to Britain or go out of Britain into what is the EU in Ireland. And that's just, you know, a slap in the face to the people of Northern Ireland who are Protestant, because they feel that they are part of Britain. And then how can you be part of Britain if you've got this boundary between you and the rest of what remains of the United Kingdom? So I don't think that's going to work. And the other option that they would have to go to would be having, because the EU is going to end up insisting on it, is a border with Northern Ireland, so that, you know, the boundaries of the EU are solid and can't be weaseled around. So that's kind of right there a no fix situation. And then the other problem, of course, is the one that Jim mentioned, which is that, you know, on both sides in Northern Ireland, the Catholic side and the Protestant side, you have people with not very distant memories of members of their family being blown up by the other side. So, you know, if this had happened 20 years from now, those memories would have kind of faded, and you would have, you know, people would have looked at the, you know, the battles of the past from the Troubles as sort of ancient history, and maybe could have, you know, would have a harder time reverting back to sectarian violence. But I don't think it's that long ago, really, when it's your father or your grandfather or your brother who was killed by somebody in a terror attack or a retaliatory assassination. So there's a lot of bad blood that's boiling just under the surface in Northern Ireland on both sides.
And Jim Kavanaugh, to that point, and this is in a New York Times article, it says you can visit the impact of the Berlin Wall, for instance, with the knowledge that the wall no longer serves its original purpose. In Belfast, however, the walls are still there to divide, their continued presence deemed necessary to prevent a resurgence of violence. So when Brexit hits, and as we expect as a result of this latest election that it will, are the walls coming down? Will the walls remain? Understanding that the tensions still ride not only high, but deep.
Oh, the walls are going to stay there. And as I said, there's a tremendous potential for an upsurge, at least a short upsurge of violence. But I don't think, you know, I think, look, the Sinn Féin won, beat the DUP, the the Unionist Party, one of the for the first time in 100 years in the Northern Belfast constituency. And the DUP, which held the kind of swing power in the Westminster over Johnson, has lost its power. So you've got this situation where there's a tremendous, you know, it's going to be very hard to put a hard border. First of all, the EU has agreed to a soft border with Northern Ireland, and I think they're going to stick to that. And what the IRA and the nationalists say, if you start putting up hard border controls in Northern Ireland, we're going to attack them. But what are the DUP, what are the unionists have to attack? Are they going to attack boats in the Irish Sea? So it's going to be very difficult. It's an upsurge, and there is not a lot of political, there's personal resentments that are still there, but it's hard to gin up the mass political resentment that was there before, because people have learned to live with an open border, and they want that. They might want to be part of Britain, but they really don't want to put that border back and fight for it. So it's going to be, and the demographics are not there. The Irish, the Catholic population will be a majority within 10 years.
Yeah, that's another thing, right?
You've got a political dynamic that does not favor the unionists.
And Dave Lindorf, to jump into that point, and one thing I want to add, as you do, is even though there has been a cessation of violence in Northern Ireland, the tensions are still very high, and there are security gates that open in the morning and close every night in West, in West Belfast, because these folks, they don't play. Go ahead, Dave Lindorf.
There's a line between all of these different communities that doesn't get crossed. I've been there also. It's quite astonishing to see two countries within each other. There's a lot of commerce is isolated within those communities. But I think there also is, you know, over the years, there's been some watering down of that. There's been, you know, the creation of a middle force that the alliance that is breaking down the barriers politically and can play a, you know, a role in coalition governing and things like that. And also, I think that just over time, the dominance of Irish culture and of the growing pressure of the, you know, the EU part of Ireland, the main Republic of Ireland, becomes dominant too, as well as a increasing percentage of Northern Ireland being the Catholic Irish. So you're gradually going to see the Protestants reduced to a less potent force, both politically and potentially militarily. So the other thing that I think is playing out here is that, you know, a lot of people in Britain are just fed up with the Northern Ireland thing. They're not going to put up with a lot of violence, and they may find we haven't talked about Scotland, but
that was the next thing on my list.
You know, there's a lot of people in Britain who sort of don't care whether Scotland goes. There's a lot of people, you know, sort of the hell with them attitude, and I think that attitude would also become stronger with regard to Northern Ireland if it was a matter of having to send British troops in there to maintain the peace, and, you know, back to the whole period of the Troubles and bombings in England and everything else. I think a lot of people, the mentality in England proper lately, and I have a daughter who lives there, that tells me the same thing, that, you know, the attitude is sort of, you know, a pox on all of them. We just want, you know, original England. So we could end up seeing the whole United Kingdom become not a United Kingdom and, you know, fracture out. Maybe not with Wales leaving too, but pretty much everything else gone.
And Jim Cavanaugh, to the point about Scotland, and I also wanted to touch on this whole idea of nationalism, because you have, I think, you have two different national allegiances on the same island. So nationalism depends on which nation you want to remain aligned with.
Oh, yeah. Look, and you see the contradictions and subtleties of nationalism, different relationships between nationalisms and the European project, the Brexit, the Europe project, the EU project, and different kinds of nationalism. I mean, Irish nationalism is something that was an anti-colonial struggle for, you know, hundreds of years.
Right.
Now you have Scottish nationalism, which was also, an anti-colonial struggle in a certain sense, but it's come back in a way that nobody kind of expected, because the Scots had been absorbed essentially in a way that all of Ireland had not, but now it's back, and they're going to have to fight about that. And I think that London and Westminster are going to be much more concerned about the loss of Scotland, you know, part of the island of Britain, and potentially Wales. The devolution of the United Kingdom is in play now in a way that's dangerous that Westminster is going to have to fight and Boris Johnson is going to have to fight. As Dave said, I think at the end of the day, the power of the large population of the Republic of Ireland versus the six counties in the north is not going to be something that anybody's going to want to fight about, really, because it's going to be a losing fight. And you now have people, some unionist politicians in Northern Ireland, willing to discuss what might happen after a reunification of the island and whether they could preserve their cultural heritage, et cetera. So, you know, this is what's going to happen. But the general devolution of the United Kingdom is something we have to look at. And this is part of the effects of Brexit.
And Dave Lindorf, you brought up Scotland, which I had on my list as the next element to discuss, and Wales. And then as we look at this nationalist issue, Northern Ireland, their nationalist proclivities go towards Britain, while the nationalism in who want a united Ireland, their nationalism is Irish and Catholic.
Yeah, that's right. And actually, in Scotland, it's interesting. The Scottish nationalists basically are looking at themselves as more of a Scandinavian country. It's a much more socialist leaning society in Scotland. They have a better national health care system. They've taken as much liberty as they can with their own, you know, the Scottish Parliament, and have made a better system, and they look at Scandinavian countries as a model.
And so Wales factoring into this as well, basically Britain is done.
Well, you know, they're in danger. I wouldn't write off Wales, nationalist movement in Wales, although it's something less developed than Scotland, but I wouldn't write it off. It's interesting, too, that the British, the Conservative Party, I think the name of the Conservative Party in Britain is actually the Conservative and Unionist Party. So they're supposed to be staunchly standing for unionism, and that's why the unionists in Northern Ireland feel betrayed by them. So I think there's going to be pressure all those through those fault lines, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland.
So we have about 3 minutes left. And so to me, the real quick question here with the very long answer, Dave Lindorf, and then I'll come back to Jim, is you've got a hard Brexit exit, at the end of January. Does that really, at the end of the day, just create bigger problems? Does the fuse get lit? And we don't know how long that fuse has to burn. But does the fuse get lit as it relates to Scotland, Wales, and Ireland?
I think there's all kinds of weird stuff that's going to happen with Brexit because, you know, the vote with a hard Brexit, the vote for Brexit was by people on the left and the right who were both fed up with links to Europe and for different reasons, you know, one being a xenophobic anti-foreign thing and the other one being, you know, concerns about the bureaucratic rules coming from Luxembourg and Brussels. And so I think that what we're going to see is that, you know, it led to a government that's purely very right-wing conservative. And that is not what a lot of the people who voted for Brexit were. So, you know, a lot of them were Labour people who gave that majority. So you're going to see a huge resistance rising to a new conservative government and the new conservative policies that are going to come in. And that's going to be a big thing, the big political thing in England. And then, you know, England proper. And then you're going to see a big drive for independence in Scotland, which I think will be hard for the government to resist. So a lot's going to be happening.
And so, Jim Kavanaugh, same question to you. We have about a minute and a half. When we look at the end of January and Brexit, is this just lighting the fuse for bigger problems in Scotland, in Wales, and in Northern Ireland?
Well, it certainly is lighting the fuse for problems about the devolution of the and the breakup of the United Kingdom. I think Scotland, for the reasons that Dave just said, you know, they have a left Scottish Labour government, essentially. They don't want this reactionary policies of Johnson. And I think that fight is going to have to be had in England for the reasons that Dave just said also. Labour constituencies voted Conservative over Brexit. And that's they don't want the rest of the Conservative program. And they're going to have to learn how to fight for that and fight for their demands within a British nation that's in what form it's going to take, we don't know, but it's going to be separate from the EU. Although I think the deal with the EU is going to be less different than we may think. But there's a whole bunch of new political fights are going to open up about leftism in Britain, about nationalism in Scotland, Ireland, and Wales. And, you know, from my point of view, good thing that the Irish may be on their road to reunification, unified Ireland. But, you know, it's going to be a heck of a scene that we're going to see developing about with these new political formations.
Gentlemen, thank you both. Happy New Year to you both. As always, thank you for your time today. Thank you for your contribution to the Critical Hour. Look forward to having you back.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us on.
Thanks. Folks, you've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. Happy New Year. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.